Moving into November, and remember the clocks have gone back. Sunrise this week will be at 7:10 a.m., sunset at 4:32. By midweek, temperatures should be at around 12 degrees Celsius, with wind speeds at 16 miles per hour.
Welcome to the Sandwell News for the blind and visually impaired community living in and around Sandwell for November the 1st. And I do apologise immediately for not mentioning the clocks going back an hour last week, but it's what will happen now, as Alice just told you.
Some highlights from the Express and Star this week. Wednesday, 22nd October. Work begins to build 70 new council flats in Tipton. More than 200 jobs coming to new dairy factory in West Bromwich. A third of churches are in danger of closing. Thursday's news, Lidl's profits triple as shoppers switch stores. 23 million new 5p coins released. A survey rates parcel delivery firms. Friday's news, work on new Friar Park Millennium Centre begins. Saturday's news, benefits of swimming for the retired. November the 1st cross-country rail disruption alert. Monday's news, Albion will rally round Josh after costly goal mistake. Funding boosts charity and school for the blind. Tuesday's news, Albion debrief. Away day worries return once again. Post office in Wensbury reopens. Shrinkflation piles pressure on household budgets.
All those stories and more coming up, courtesy of Express and Star Publications. We have a lot to squeeze in this week, and at the end of this edition, I'll be playing the first part of an interview Prince did with a guy who knows all about the church in the garden at Blackheath, which I'm afraid is a walk I never got to go on. I was busy doing something else at the time. But the usual TV and radio listings for the week ahead, and we will have a West Bromwich Albion match report this week, but of course the news isn't good on that front. But first, some breaking news, an email that came in last night about an event coming up on Monday at SVI in West Bromwich.
Let's talk about IT. On Monday 3rd November from 1 p.m, we are starting a series of sessions to build on our previous digital programme with Steve Nutt. We want to help people gain confidence and get the most out of smart devices and using the internet. Kevin Priest from Black Country Housing Group, funded by the National Lottery, will be coming to talk to us about how we would like to improve our digital skills or even learn how to make a start. Over the past 10 years or more, smart devices have allowed us to access online content, but sometimes our smart devices don't work the way we would expect them to. This is where a peer support group can help. We can give each other hints and tips on how to get the best out of these devices. Kevin will lead on these initial sessions. After that, it will be up to us how we continue to offer each other support. Why not come along on Monday to find out more? Absolute beginners to confident users are all welcome. You may have questions on where to start, and the experts among us may have the answers. We look forward to welcoming you on Monday in the SVI Common Room. Please let us know if you are coming to this session. The SVI team, email info@sandwellvisuallyimpaired.org.uk. Website, sandwellvisuallyimpaired.org.uk. Telephone, 01215254810.
And that sounds as if it could be a very good addition to the SVI activities. For those who've got the podcast going on their various devices, you might well hear about that in time on Friday, and even on the streaming Talking News, which should be available on our website about that time. Now, one more bit of news, or rather an item that's coming up. Remember, it is the 5th of November on Wednesday.
Everyone has the right to enjoy fireworks. They are part of our traditions, but let's try to do it responsibly and with animals in mind. One simple step is to ensure public displays are advertised in advance so pet owners, like myself, have time to prepare and keep their furry friends safe and comfortable.
And Mia will be back later in this edition with the full piece that she wrote up for us in extra quick time about fireworks safety and being considerate to other people and, of course, pet owners and guide dog and service animal owners as well. But now on to the first day's news.
Hi everyone, it's Mia, and today I'm going to be reading some newspaper articles from the Express and Star, Wednesday the 22nd of October. I hope everyone's well. It's a bit of a shame about the weather and how gloomy, dark, rainy it's been recently. But yeah, hopefully we see a turn in the weather and it becomes a little bit more sunny for everyone. I myself am celebrating my dog's second birthday next Monday, so we're really hoping that there's nice weather so we can at least take her somewhere. Yeah, I hope everyone else is up to something nice. Work begins on £20 million new council flats, but urgent solution still needed. Work has officially started to build 70 new council flats in Tipton. Sandwell Council is building the new social housing in Union Street, as part of a £20 million plan to regenerate its town centre. A groundbreaking ceremony, attended by councillors and construction firm Torsion, was held at the site in Tipton Town Centre last week. Two ageing blocks of council flats in Union Street have already been demolished and will be replaced with 55 new flats, while the town's former Conservative Club will also be converted into 15 new flats as part of the works. The council said it will also be making improvements to Owen Street and the town centre's public spaces. The flats would help address the chronic shortage of affordable housing and long waiting lists for housing, the council says. But with more than 17,000 waiting for a council property and the average wait for a council flat averaging at least a year, it is unlikely to go a long way in tackling the problem. Sandwell Council's Cabinet Member for Housing, Councillor Vicky Smith, said the shortages were a long-term problem that needed an urgent solution. Obviously, at the moment, the housing waiting list is growing, and it's not just a Sandwell issue. It's a national issue, she said, but any housing we can provide will be much needed and hopefully much loved by the residents who move into them. It is very much a drop in the ocean, she added. We are using our right to buy receipts to buy properties as well as build new properties. So that is a boost for our housing stock. But I agree that it's a long-term problem that needs an urgent solution. Figures from last year revealed the extent of the housing crisis in Sandwell, with more than 17,000 people facing long waits for a council house, nearly triple the figure from 4 years earlier. The average wait for a council flat in Sandwell is between 10 and 15 months, depending on the person's circumstances, whereas the average wait for a house, which is in the greatest demand, could fall anywhere between 20 months and 10 years. The local authority admitted that even if it paused applications, it would still take 13 years to clear its waiting list. Councillor Peter Hughes, Cabinet Member for Regeneration and Infrastructure, said the council was looking to work with Homes England and housing associations to build social housing on surplus council land, as well as the West Midlands Combined Authority, to help with remediating the region's former industrial land. Charge brought in pet food case. A man has been charged with shop theft after hundreds of pounds of pet food were stolen from an Aldbury store. The theft took place last month, from a store on Aldbury Green Retail Park, with around £300 of food taken. After CCTV inquiries and speaking to witnesses, a man was arrested at West Bromwich bus station on Monday. Carlton Fraser, aged 27 from West Bromwich, has been charged with shop theft. He was remanded in custody to appear at Wolverhampton Magistrates Court yesterday. Sandwell South has its own dedicated retail crime team, which identifies prolific offenders and brings them to justice. A police spokesperson said, "We're catching hundreds more suspected shop thieves in the West Midlands as we continue to act against retail crime across the region." Family pay tribute to mother who was doctor and athlete. Tributes have been paid to one of the first female doctors in Midlands, who has died aged 94. Dr. Gwen Harris worked at the Royal Shrewsbury Hospital before becoming school's medical officer in West Bromwich, and later a GP in Tipton. Her family have described her as a remarkable woman. Born on April 30th, 1931, in Brockenhurst, Hampshire, she was the eldest of two daughters to Archibald Plumley and wife Ruth. In her early teens, Gwen set her heart on becoming a doctor and spent school holidays at a local hospital to gain some experience. She was the first girl from her sixth form to gain a place at medical school and was one of only four female students out of an intake of about 65 to gain a place on the medical course at Leeds University. During her school years, she discovered an aptitude for high jumping and the 200-metre sprint, representing Hampshire in athletics competitions. She was approached by athletics coaches to trial for the 1952 Olympics, but decided her medical studies would suffer if she pursued an athletic career. She continued to jump for British universities and international competitions, and it was at the university's Christian Union she met her future husband, Bernard Harris. The couple married in 1957, and Gwen started working at Royal Shrewsbury Hospital, where Bernard was a curate. The couple later settled in Hilltop, West Bromwich. In 1966, where Gwen became school's medical officer, while Bernard became vicar of St. James's Church. The couple moved to Sedley when Bernard took up the post as rector of All Saints Church, and Dr. Harris became senior partner at Glebfield's GP practice. The couple were married for 68 years. They were inseparable, says daughter Deborah. She leaves Bernard six children, son Jonathan and daughters Deborah, Kath, Caroline, Sarah and Joanna, 19 grandchildren and 5 great-grandchildren. Sadly, Gwen never saw the 6th great-grandchild, Lenny, who was born days after her death. Her funeral is on November 4th at St. Peter's Collegiate Church, Wolverhampton. And I also wanted to just describe some of the pictures on this article. So in the top left corner, we see Gwen performing the high jump for Leeds University. She's properly going for it. She's kind of screaming. And it looks like everyone's watching her, cheering her on. The picture to the right of this is Gwen with her proud parents on graduation day. They're all happily smiling. And in the bottom right corner, we have Gwen working as a GP at Glebfield Surgery in Tipton. More than 200 jobs will be created at new £25 million dairy factory in town. More than 200 jobs are to be created at a state-of-the-art new milk and dairy processing factory in West Bromwich, the Mayor of the West Midlands has announced. Freshways, the UK's largest independent dairy supplier, has invested £25 million in a facility which will pasteurise and package almost 900 million pints of fresh milk a year, enough to fill 200 Olympic-sized swimming pools. More than 200 people will be employed at the dairy, which is nearing completion, with more jobs likely to follow as the plant scales up, and the business will focus on recruiting local young people in support of the Mayor's youth employment plan. The British company has also imported specialist milk processing machinery from India in one of the first major deals to be completed since the UK and Indian governments struck a free trade deal in July. Mayor of the West Midlands, Richard Parker, said, "This major investment in West Bromwich will support British dairy farming, bolster our food supply chain, and create at least 200 new jobs for local people, helping me to deliver on my growth plan." It also clearly shows how strong trade relationships with India benefit our region, bringing specialist Indian engineering to create one of the UK's most advanced dairy facilities on our doorstep. And it is another vote of confidence in the West Midlands as the best place to invest and grow a business. A third of churches are in danger of closure. Many fear they will no longer be a place of worship by 2030. They used to be at the centre of British life. but churches are increasingly becoming part of its history. Almost a third of churches surveyed across the UK are said to have uncertain futures, with about 2,000 feeling they might not be used as a place of worship by the end of the decade. The National Churches Trust, a charity which helps churches stay open and in use, commissioned a survey of more than 3,000 churches from various denominations across the UK. It found that 1 in 20 churches, which it said was equivalent to about 2,000 churches UK-wide, said they would either definitely or probably not be used as a place of worship by 2030. It is a familiar scenario in the West Midlands. A quick internet search will bring many examples of former churches that are now being put to other uses. Newton Road United Reformed Church in Great Barr, which is 100 years old, closed in 2017. It is now set to be converted into a new Kung Fu martial arts gym with new offices and flats. The former Bethel Mission Church on Hagley Road is up for sale for £250,000 more than a year ago, after being used as a community centre following its closure as a church in 2015. An empty former Ford House's Methodist Church off Stafford Road is set to be knocked down and replaced with 9 2- and 3-bedroom houses if a planning application is approved by Wolverhampton Council. The church, which is 90 years old, closed in March 2020 because of failing congregation numbers and has been empty since. Perhaps the highest profile of them all is the former Darlington Street Methodist Church in Wolverhampton, one of the most ornate buildings in the city and Grade 2 listed. It held its last service in 2018 after 118 years of worship and is now a banqueting hall. Overall, almost two-thirds of churches approached in the new survey said they were confident they would definitely remain open, but 27% were less certain and could only say they would probably remain open as a place of worship in 5 years' time. 5% said they would probably not or definitely not stay open. The remaining 4% said they did not know. More than a fifth of churches said their building had deteriorated in the last 5 years, while almost 4 in 10 reported that their roof was either at risk or in urgent need of repair. The survey across England, Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland included buildings in the Catholic Church, Church of England, Church of Scotland, Methodist Church and the Church in Wales. Almost a third of churches surveyed are drawing on church reserves to cover basic costs, while almost half reported a lack of volunteer time as a major barrier to doing more in their community. National Churches Trust Chairman Sir Philip Rutnam said, "Our churches stand as extraordinary witnesses to history, places where beauty, belonging and service to the community have flourished for centuries. Without intervention, the risks are enormous. We will lose more and more of these buildings and all they embody for good. To secure a future for the UK's historic churches, the UK government, denominations and heritage bodies must all recognise their leadership roles, act together and act fast." A government spokesperson said, "Listed places of worship serve as vital community hubs for faith communities, whilst providing valuable services to the wider public. Many are buildings of exceptional architectural and historical significance that form an integral part of our national heritage. The Listed Places of Worship grant scheme enables religious organisations to claim grants covering eligible VAT costs for essential repairs and renovations. This sits alongside substantial additional funding available through DCMS and our arm's length bodies, including £100 million from the National Lottery Heritage Fund, allocated between 2023 and 2026, ensuring these treasured buildings can continue serving their communities for generations to come.
Hello, this is Jan Lloyd, reading articles from The Express and Star on the 23rd of October. Lidl profits more than triple as shoppers switch stores. The sales rise comes amid plans to open even more stores. An article by Henry Saker Clark. Lidl has revealed a threefold surge in profits as more shoppers switched from its supermarket rivals amid the rising cost of living. It came as bosses at German discount chain said they plan to keep opening more stores as it pushes ahead with ambitious expansion plans across the UK. On Wednesday, Lidl GB revealed that sales jumped by 7.9% to £11.7 billion for the year to February the 28th, compared with a year earlier. It said the increase in sales and significant store investment helped pre-tax profits more than triple to £156.8 million from £43.6 million a year earlier. The company was the UK's fastest growing supermarket chain over the year as it benefited from stronger customer demand and new shops. It is currently the UK's sixth largest grocery chain according to the experts at World Panel, after taking a record share of the sector in recent months. Lidl is expected to overtake rival Morrisons, which is currently in fifth place, in the coming months if its current momentum continues. The retailer said it was buoyed by 38 million more visits from customers over the year, as many shoppers switched from supermarket rivals. Ryan McDonnell, Lidl GB chief executive, told PA News Agency, "Our gains from customer switching supermarkets are balanced across all our competitors. We have been focused on delivering lower prices and high quality, and that has been really well received by shoppers." Lidl has also welcomed more shoppers on the back of opening new stores, with the retailer expecting to have opened around 40 shops by the end of the year. It said it is on track to surpass 1,000 stores and hopes to keep opening new locations at a similar pace. And the photograph accompanying the article is of the huge Lidl sign outside a supermarket in Chichester, down on the south coast. All change as 23 million 5p coins are released by Vicky Shaw, personal finance correspondent. The first 5p coins bearing the portrait of the king will start to show up in people's wallets and pockets soon. The Royal Mint has announced 23.2 million King Charles 5p coins are entering circulation across the UK. The coins, dated and minted in October 2023, are being released due to increased demand for the 5p denomination, the Mint said. The release marks the first time the 5p denomination has entered circulation bearing the King's official portrait, creating another opportunity for coin collectors and the wider public to find historic coins in their everyday change, it added. Since the introduction of the King's portrait on UK coinage in 2022, collectors have been eagerly seeking coins bearing the new royal effigy, the Mint said. King Charles coins represent only around 0.2% of the 24.605 billion coins currently in circulation across the UK. The new 5p coins feature an oak tree leaf design on the reverse, or tail side, signifying the tree's role as a rich habitat for biodiversity in woodlands. The oak tree has a long association with monarchs, and the design highlights the king's passion for conservation. And the photograph that accompanies this picture is a blurred face and a hand that's very much in focus, holding the 5p coin in front of it. Vasanthi Balanchanda, branch manager of Jubilee Oak Post Office in Essex, who's displaying the first Charles 5p coin. Council dedicated to nurturing new talent. Sandwell Council is proud to be recognised as a leading force in public sector apprenticeship delivery. Since 2017, the Council has supported over 1,100 individuals into apprenticeship roles, with more than 650 joining as new entrants. Apprentices are employed across every department, including Sandwell Schools, and a range in age from 16 to 62, reflecting the Council's commitment to inclusive and lifelong learning. In August 2025, Sandwell launched its ambitious 100 New Apprentices by 2027 programme, building on the momentum of the Making It Sandwell campaign, which celebrates the voices and journeys of young people from across the borough. This dedication to nurturing talent was nationally recognised when Sandwell Council was ranked 64th in the top 100 apprenticeship employers in 2025, one of only four local authorities to feature. The council also received a highly commended in the large employer category at the Regional Apprenticeship Awards 2025 and won the same category in 2023, a testament to the programme's strong completion rates, diverse recruitment and the positive feedback from apprentices themselves. Sandwell apprentices have recently featured in promotional materials for the local government association's Make a Difference, Work for Your Local Council national recruitment campaign. Beyond apprenticeship, Sandwell's council also offers support to those looking for work with employment and skills officers available to provide advice and guidance in community venues around the borough. Councillor Saeed Khatoun, Cabinet Member for Education, Business and Skills, says, as a top 100 UK apprenticeship employer, Sandwell Council is proud to offer inclusive, high-quality opportunities. Part of our Sandwell story, our apprentices gain valuable skills working alongside passionate teams across services. We're committed to building a diverse, future-ready workforce that reflects our communities and supports local people into long-term employment. For more information on apprenticeships available within Sandwell Council and the support available, visit sandwell.gov.uk/apprenticeships. And the article is accompanied by two young men who the council offers opportunities to, who appear to be standing working at Sandwell Valley Farm. Survey rates parcel firms. Evri and Yodel have the least happy customers when it comes to contacting delivery companies for help, an annual survey by the regulator has found. Amazon and FedEx have jointly taken the top spot in Ofcom's customer satisfaction survey for parcel delivery firms. While average overall satisfaction is reasonably high at 78%, unchanged from last year, consumers have revealed widely varying experiences depending on which delivery firm their parcel is delivered from. Last year, UK consumers sent and received a record 4.2 billion parcels, which was 7% more than the previous year. Across all operators, more than two-thirds of consumers, 68%, experienced a delivery issue in the past 6 months. Yodel and Evri, at the bottom of the ranking, only managed scores of 38% and 31% respectively. Both firms also had the highest levels of dissatisfaction, with Evri scoring 41% and Yodel 33%. We can't wait to get started, says boss of New Dairy Factory, by Beverly Radmacher, business editor. The boss of a new state-of-the-art milk and dairy processing factory in West Bromwich has spoken of his plans for the hub, saying, "We can't wait to get started." Freshways, the UK's largest independent dairy supplier, has invested £25 million in the facility, which will pasteurise and package almost 900 million pints of fresh milk a year. More than 200 people will be employed at the dairy, which is nearing completion, with more jobs likely to follow as the plant scales up. And the business will focus on recruiting local young people in support of the Mayor's Youth Employment Plan. Bali Najjar, Managing Director of Freshways, says, "This new West Midlands dairy hub is ideally located to collect more fresh milk from our loyal British farmers, processing and packing in efficiently, sustainably, before moving it on to our new customers. We can't wait to get started in the West Midlands and look forward to welcoming our new colleagues into the business. Our Indian engineering partners and local contractors are working round the clock to get things ready, and we very much hope to start bringing millions of litres of delicious fresh British milk to the site by the end of the year." Recruitment for staff at the new dairy on the Park Rose Industrial Estate will start shortly, with roles available in engineering, quality assurance, food safety, logistics and support services. The British company has also imported specialist milk processing machinery from India in one of the first major deals to be completed since the UK and Indian governments struck a free trade deal in July. Councillor Kerry Carmichael, leader of Sandwell Council, welcomed the investment, saying it shows people can think big in Sandwell. She said, "This is great news for West Bromwich. We have a long history of industrial innovation and people making it here in Sandwell. So welcoming the new Freshways plant with its international collaboration and new jobs is another chapter in our story. This shows that we can really think big when we encourage investment in Sandwell. As part of our ambition to drive economic growth in the Black Country Growth Corridor, a key element of West Midlands' growth plan. Mayor of the West Midlands, Richard Parker, said, "This major investment in West Bromwich will support British dairy farming, bolster our food supply chain and create at least 200 new jobs for local people." And the article is accompanied by a photograph of Bali Najjar, the MD of Freshways, Richard Parker and Councillor Kerry Carmichael standing alongside a huge van, the side of which has got an advert for the firm on it, where there's a little milk bottle with two eyes and little arms and wiggly legs. And it says on the side of it, "Your farm fresh dairy is on the move," with many O's written inside the word move.
Hello there, it's Gavin, and I've got some readings for you from the 24th of October. New homes bid after surgery flattened without permission. A developer has asked to rebuild new flats on the site of a former doctor's surgery after demolishing the building without permission. Sandwell Council approved plans to convert the empty former doctor's surgery in Newton Road, Great Bar, into eight new flats in 2024. The planning application had included building a number of two-storey extensions, adding some balconies and carrying out a loft conversion to make way for the new flats. However, when work finally began in June, the building was eventually demolished without permission from the council after it was deemed unsafe by a structural engineer. The developer was told the unauthorised demolition of the building meant the planning permission for the eight flats had been cancelled in August. This has resulted in the submission of the new application to Sandwell Council. A statement included with the latest application said, "It is important to note that every reasonable and practicable effort was made to implement the permission in accordance with the approved drawings and methodologies. However, due to a series of interrelated structural deficiencies and safety concerns that arose during the course of the initial works, full demolition of the existing building became necessary. As a result, the development is no longer capable of being implemented in accordance with the approved permission, and said permission is therefore considered null and void. The former doctor's surgery in Newton Road has been empty since private healthcare company Summerfield Heath went into administration in 2023. Several entries on the consumer review website Trustpilot claimed people awaiting treatment were scammed out of hundreds of pounds when the Great Bar surgery closed suddenly and vanished into thin air, according to one furious patient. The angry review said the man had allegedly paid the sum of £600 for a surgical procedure, only to find the building empty when he arrived for the treatment in March last year. Dozens of similar complaints were made online by out-of-pocket patients following the surgery's sudden closure. You can find out more about planning applications and planned roadworks where you live online by visiting public-noticeportal.uk. Remarkable transformation is applauded in school's report. A Tipton school has been celebrating after receiving a significant result in its latest Ofsted inspection, highlighting the work done to make improvements across school life. Gospel Oak School, which is part of the Central Region Schools Trust, is celebrating what it has called a period of remarkable transformation following its latest Ofsted inspection, which recognised significant improvements across key areas of school life. The inspection, carried out on September 30th and October 1st, confirmed the school is now rated good for behaviour and attitudes, personal development, leadership and management, and sixth form provision. Inspectors stated that pupils and staff agree that Gospel Oak School is a school that is transformed, and described how pupils feel proud to have been a part of that change by meeting the school's expectations, developing positive attitudes and treating each other with respect, and how the school has high expectations and is ambitious for pupils' futures. While rated requires improvement for quality of education, the school said the positive progress made across all other judgment areas marks an impressive turnaround for the school, which has undergone a comprehensive programme of improvements since its previous inspection. Pupils and staff alike told inspectors that the school has been transformed, a reflection of the dedication and shared ambition across the entire school community. Inspectors highlighted many strengths across the school, including a positive shift in behaviour, highlighting that pupils behave well, and that the school is a calm place where pupils feel safe. while the report also praises the warm relationships between pupils and staff. Stephen Brownlow, Executive Principal at Gospel Oak School, said, "This report is a testament to the hard work, determination and belief of everyone at Gospel Oak School, our pupils, staff, parents and carers and wider community. We are incredibly proud of how far we have come and remain absolutely committed to continuing our journey of improvement so that every pupil can achieve their very best." Guy Shears, Central Region School Trust's Chief Executive, said, "This transformation shows what can be achieved through strong leadership, high expectations and a relentless focus on pupils' well-being and success. Central Region Schools Trust is immensely proud of the progress made and will continue to support the school as it builds on this success." There is a quick image here, two pupils, and the caption underneath says, "Ofsted inspectors praise the school's journey of transformation." And it's just got the two children there doing artwork in class. Work begins on new centre as part of investment in town. A Black Country community is celebrating the start of what is planned long-term investment in the town. Friar Park Millennium Centre, a community hub in the heart of Wednesbury, celebrated a major milestone with the official spade-in-the-ground ceremony marking the start of its expansion and refurbishment project. The new development is part of the Levelling Up Partnership programme, a government-backed initiative aimed at boosting the economy in areas that need it most. The fund has already seen Wednesbury benefit from a new town square, tree planting, new paving and new CCTV installed alongside other crime prevention measures. Kellyanne Titley, Chair of the Wednesbury Levelling Up Board, said, "The Friar Park Millennium Centre is being expanded to better serve the growing community. The extension will add much needed space for new programmes, including youth services and skills development projects, and space for the community to come together. It will also mean we have permanent library space. I hope people in Wednesbury are already seeing the impact of our investment with the recent official opening of Ethelfleda Square, new trees and CCTV." Paul Fish, Operations Director for Seddon Property Services, said, "Breaking ground on the Millennium Centre marks an exciting step in delivering a modern, energy-efficient facility designed to serve Wednesbury for generations to come. Friar Park has also been selected to receive up to £20 million investment from the government's new Pride in Place programme." There's an image here as well of the spade in the ground ceremony with all the workers and people there, I think from Seddon mainly as well, all with the high-vis vests on. There's a digger in the background. And yeah, the spades are going in the ground. Caption here reads, "Celebrations as work begins at the Wednesbury Millennium Centre."
Hello everybody, this is Linda, reading from Saturday the 25th of October's Express and Star. Boss Mason is only focused on Albion's journey. Boss Ryan Mason claims the struggle for consistency across the board in the Championship is irrelevant to Albion. The second tier table is showing few signs of spreading out after 11 fixtures, with Mason's Baggies in Suffolk to tackle relegated Premier League outfit Ipswich on Saturday lunchtime. Wednesday's defeat at Watford saw Albion drop to 10th, when victory would have taken them 3rd. The table reads just 3 points up to 3rd, while only 4 separate the Baggies and Portsmouth in 17th. Mason is not interested in the layout of the league and is determined to focus on his own club's journey. "Other clubs are irrelevant to me and irrelevant to us," Mason said, when asked about numerous clubs striving for consistency. "We're on our own journey. I think the challenging things you saw on Wednesday is that we're not one of the biggest squads, and that's something that we need to manage. There's also some players inside of the team at the moment that it's probably not right to play them 3 games in a week because they're not built up the robustness and they're not ready for it. There was illness, Christian Bielik, and a contract injury for Alfie Gilchrist, which is disappointing and something we can do nothing about. Albion face an Ipswich side down in 14th, and notice that about the start of the current campaign is just one relegated Premier League side, boosted by parachute payment, 9th place Leicester, in the top 13 places. Consistency has so far evaded a number of clubs, including Mason's Albion, whose sole back-to-back victories came in the first 2 league games of the season, though they were separated by a penalty shootout defeat in the EFL Cup. Dive in and reap the benefits of swimming when you are retired. Stripping off and diving into a swimming pool can seem daunting, but braving the water could be one of the best decisions you ever make for your mental and physical health. I've seen the difference swimming makes in people's lives, especially for older adults, says Emma Quirtz-Norman, National Swim Manager at Nuffield Health. It's not just about keeping fit. It's about feeling confident, staying independent, and enjoying life to the fullest. Retirement is the perfect time to work on movement, and the pool is one of the safest and most effective places to start. When you compare swimming to other low-impact activities like walking or cycling, it really does stand out. Here are some tips on how to get started. Takes pressure off the joints. The water takes the pressure off your joints, which makes it ideal for anyone dealing with arthritis, osteoporosis, or general stiffness. It's low impact, but still gives you a full body workout, says Quirtz-Norman. You're still building strength, improving flexibility, and getting your heart working. Improves mental health. It's not just about physical fitness. It genuinely helps people feel calmer, more in control, and more balanced. Swimming has this brilliant way of helping you reset, both mentally and emotionally, says Quirtz-Norman. Creates a sense of community. Although swimming is often viewed as a solitary activity, an outdoor pool or a leisure centre offers a shared space which nurtures connection. One of the things I think sometimes gets missed is just how much of a community swimming creates, says Quirtz-Norman. Whether it's chatting in the changing rooms, joining a group session, or just being around others in the pool, it brings people together in such a genuine way. Friendships are formed in the pool, in the cafe, or just through casual conversations before and after sessions. Boosts cardiovascular health. Swimming is a fantastic way to improve your cardiovascular health, helping to strengthen the heart, improve circulation, and lower blood pressure, all of which help to reduce the risk of cardiovascular diseases, says Inez Griffin, senior health and well-being physiologist at Nuffield Health. Builds muscle strength. Swimming enhances strength, particularly around the core, and also improves our posture, both of which are crucial for maintaining balance and preventing falls, says the expert. If you are a novice who doesn't know where to start, here are some tips on how to increase your confidence in the pool safely. Talk to your GP. Talk to your GP before getting started, especially if you've got any health concerns. Start slow and don't worry about technique, speed, or what you look like in your costume. Even just walking through the water or using a float to get started can make a real difference. Consider adult classes. Adult Learn to Swim programs are all about building confidence step by step, supporting everyone from complete beginners to competent swimmers. Start with gentler strokes. For beginners, strokes like breaststroke or backstroke are a great place to start. They're gentle, easy to breathe through, and help you find a rhythm. PE teacher barred from teaching after lying about playing for West Brom. A PE teacher from the Wirral has been banned from teaching after falsely saying that he was a former player for West Bromwich Albion and Leicester City. A professional conduct panel has barred Aaron Smith, aged 44, from teaching in schools indefinitely after finding that he had lied repeatedly about his employment history. The conduct panel on October the 3rd was held by the Teaching Regulation Agency and headed by panel chair Tony Coyne, and concerned the misconduct of Mr. Smith over his teaching career. The panel found that when Mr. Smith completed his application form for Woodlands Primary School in Birkenhead in July 2015, he had stated that he had formerly been employed at Leicester City Council. He also stated that he had been a former professional apprentice football player at West Bromwich Albion Football Club from June 1997 to April 2000. He also stated that he had been employed as a professional football player at Leicester City Football Club from June 2000 to December 2001. The lie came to light after an assembly that was held in February 2016, when he shared his experiences of being a former player for both clubs. However, following the assembly, a pupil or a parent contacted the school saying that they could not find information about Mr. Smith online. He later joined the Co-op Academy Bebbington in the Wirral, but concerns were raised over Mr. Smith's repeated absence. The panel found Mr. Smith had fallen significantly short of the standards expected of the teaching profession. Mr. Smith has the right to appeal the order after a period of 5 years. Rail disruption alert amid industrial action. Cross-country customers are being warned of significant travel disruption in a second planned day of industrial action by the RMT union next week. The strike will see RMT union members in customer-facing roles declining to work and represents the second day of industrial action currently planned by RMT members at cross-country. All cross-country routes will be impacted on Saturday, November the 1st, with a limited service on many routes and no services on others, including at Wolverhampton Station. Services will also finish much earlier than usual. Trains that run will be significantly busier than usual, and services will also finish much earlier in the day. So passengers are advised to plan return journeys carefully. There will also be changes to some calling patterns, so passengers should plan their journeys carefully before travelling. No cross-country services will call at Wolverhampton, Worcestershire Parkway, Wakefield Westgate or Chesterfield, with customers instead encouraged to use shorter distance services. Shona Rolfe, cross-country's managing director, says, "We are disappointed that the RMT is undertaking a second day of planned industrial action. Passengers planning to travel with cross-country on November the 1st should check before their travel with National Rail Inquiries." Woman jailed after dog walker attack and making threats. A woman who attacked a dog walker and then barged into a bungalow where she had fled for sanctuary has been jailed. Aliyah Chandy, 30, saw a female dog walker in Oakwood Park on August the 15th and asked her for a cigarette, then demanded money before putting her in a headlock and pushing her to the floor. After freeing herself, the lady ran to a nearby bungalow on Bill Hay Street for sanctuary. However, Chandy followed her and barged through the front door, hurting the homeowner's leg as she tried to stop her entry. The two women barricaded themselves in the living room as Chandy ransacked the house looking for something to steal. She was also threatening to kill them as she tried to push through the barricaded room. When Chandy was arrested, she continued her frenzied behaviour, spitting at officers and racially abusing a black officer. Chandy pleaded guilty to attempted robbery, burglary and racially aggravated harassment and was sentenced at Wolverhampton Crown Court. The two women who were attacked and abused by Chandy were said to be frightened to leave their home and do not feel safe living in West Bromwich anymore. Chandy, who appeared in court via video link from Foston Hall Women's Prison, has 13 convictions for 33 offences, which include violence and thieving. In mitigation, the court heard Chandy was battling drug addiction and was remorseful for her actions. She also has a child and pleaded guilty at the first opportunity. Recorder Ben Mills sentenced Chandy of no fixed abode to 2.5 years imprisonment. He said, "You saw a dog walker in West Bromwich and asked her for a cigarette, and then you grabbed her around the head. The woman told you she had no money. You then repeatedly shouted, 'Where do you live?' She said she would try and get some money, but then ran to a bungalow to escape. This was the time you could have reflected on your behaviour and left it at that. Instead, you followed the lady and beat your way in, hurting one of your victim's leg. They were so scared of you, they barricaded themselves in the living room. They could hear you ransacking the place and going from room to room, emptying wardrobes and cupboards." He added, "When you were arrested, you continued to scream and shout and tried to spit at the officer. You threatened to headbutt a female officer and then racially abused her, making her feel distraught. You have previous convictions, including racial offences, which is an aggravated factor. I hope you reflect on your behaviour during your sentence."
Hello, this is Janet reading from the Express and Star for Monday, October the 27th. Albion will rally round Josh after costly mistake. Ryan Mason insists Albion will rally behind goalkeeper Josh Griffiths after his late mistake proved costly in the defeat at Ipswich. Academy graduate Griffiths, 24, was at fault as his sloppy pass out of goal saw Alex Mowat dispossessed and hosts Ipswich bagged an 83rd-minute winner through Jack Clark. Griffiths, in his breakthrough campaign as Baggies number one, has enjoyed some impressive appearances, notably in wins at Norwich and at home to Preston the previous weekend. But his error cost Albion dear in Suffolk on a day defensive Albion looked well-placed for the point they eyed, but did not manage an effort on target until stoppage time after falling behind. We need to learn. I think with Josh, this is probably his first full season in the Championship at this level, at this club, Mason said of his goalkeeper. And yes, we will support him. We're here for him. And we need to give the players the best platform and all take the responsibility together. So to all of us, it's a situation that we deal with together. Mason called on his players to learn from and improve from lessons in game management following last Wednesday's 2-1 defeat at Watford, having conceded shortly after opening the scoring. But Albion showed little sign of heeding the warning in Ipswich with the manner of the late winner. Mason explained that balls out from Albion's penalty box from the goalkeeper was not part of the game plan against the Tractor Boys. I think you see in the game, normally we play through the middle a lot from our goalkeeper, the head coach added. It's a big part of our game, but we didn't on Saturday. I think if you look throughout the whole game, I don't know how many times we played it in there because that wasn't what we wanted to do, but we did. It's a reminder that your concentration slips for a brief second, you get punished. Police object to new club at bar that shut after shooting. Serious concerns raised over lounge application for site of attempted murder. By Christian Barnett. West Midlands Police has raised serious concerns over plans to open a new late-night club at a former bar that was forced to close after a shooting. Castriot Haxaj applied to Sandwell Council in September to open the West Side Lounge on the first floor of the former Avenue Bar and Grill in Rolfe Street, Smethwick. The bar and grill was forced to close down after it was the scene of an attempted murder in 2024, following an early hours shooting, and police later discovered a £300,000 cannabis farm during a raid a year later. West Midlands Police has objected to the new move, saying it has serious concerns over opening another late-night venue given the building's recent history. However, Rob Edge, representing Mr. Haxaj, said it was inappropriate and unjust for West Midlands Police to object over unconnected past events at the venue, and the application should be judged on its own merits. He added the force's objection was misdirected. At the outset, it is essential to emphasise that this is a new application by a new applicant who has no connection with any previous owners or licence holders associated with the premises, he said in a response to Sandwell Council. The incidents referenced to by West Midlands Police relate entirely to the operation of the premises under previous ownership and management during the period of a now revoked licence. The applicant was not involved in the running of the venue at that time. It would be therefore be inappropriate and unjust to attribute past incidents or management failings to the current applicant. The application had sought permission to sell alcohol and play live and recorded music at the High Class Lounge Bar every day from 8 a.m. to 3 a.m. and open until 3:30 a.m. Sandwell Council's Licensing Committee meets in Albury on Thursday to make a decision. Avenue Bar and Grill had its licence revoked by Sandhill Council in July 2024 after the shooting. The licence was suspended a month earlier, pending a full investigation with West Midlands Police calling for it to be revoked. Police carried out a raid at the former bar and grill on August the 1st, finding 300 cannabis plants, more drugs and an imitation gun hidden inside a printer. A large amount of money was also seized from gambling machines, and officers found the building's electricity had been bypassed. Jack Cabea was one of three men identified by police over the attempted murder at the bar and grill on June the 17th last year. After learning of an associate's arrest, the 21-year-old Cabea, who had previous convictions for drugs and knife offences, fled to the Democratic Republic of Congo using his brother's passport. He was arrested at Gatwick Airport on his return from Qatar around 3 weeks later. Last October, Cabea of Kitchener Road, Selly Park, admitted at Birmingham Crown Court to two charges of possessing someone else's identity document with intent and was sentenced to 22 months in prison. No strings attached. Puppet Festival set to be the biggest yet, by Helen Stallard. Theatre, dance and cinema group Black Country Touring has confirmed the return of a popular puppet festival, saying it will be the biggest yet. Smethwick Puppetry Festival in 2026, which will run during half term from February the 14th to the 22nd, will see a packed programme of free and low-cost events happening across Smethwick and Bearwood. The festival is set to be the biggest to date, with performances by UK's leading professional puppetry theatre companies. There will be puppet theatre especially made for children and families, plus performances for teens and adults, interactive puppetry workshops, an exhibition and more. It will take place in community venues across Smethwick and Bearwood, including Dorothy Park Centre, Smethwick Library and Thimble Mill Library. This year, for the first time, local illustrator Catherine Tromans has designed a set of merchandise available exclusively through a time-limited crowdfunder campaign. Limited edition prints, tote bags and t-shirts will be revealed over the next few weeks, with suggested donations ranging from £10 to £500. The crowdfunder has been designed to help keep the festival affordable, with tickets for all events on a pay-as-you-feel basis. Genevieve Say from Black Country Touring explains, "Smethwick Puppetry Festival is going from strength to strength, and this year, for the first time, we developed a range of limited edition prints and wearables by local illustrator Catherine Tromans. They will be revealed over the next few weeks and will only be available for a short time. So we're urging fans and supporters to get online and snap them up now, knowing that they are supporting the future of the festival at the same time. Support from the crowdfunder helps us to keep tickets on a pay-what-you-feel basis while still delivering an ambitious programme. So it's a double win for the festival. The crowdfunder campaign runs until November. Black Country Touring aims to raise a modest £2,000 from the campaign, which will go some way to covering the costs of the festival and allow it to remain accessible to everyone. All events will be either free or pay what you can, which means that you choose how much to pay to attend." Genevieve added, "Smethwick Puppetry Festival transforms February half term into a week of joy, laughter and connection. In 2025, over 1,400 people came together to see magical puppet shows, take part in workshops and share moments they'll never forget. It's such a special event, to bring to our community. Black Country Touring is able to run the Puppetry Festival thanks to the funds raised by players of the People's Postcode Lottery. For more details, visit bctouring.org.uk/puppet. Join the crowdfunder at crowdfunder.co.uk/p/Smethwick Puppetry Festival. Funding Boosts School and Charity for the Blind by Kerry Ashdown. A village sports club and support service for blind and partially sighted people will benefit from government funding. A school is also set to transform an underused caretaker's building into a community hub offering food to families facing hardship after being awarded almost £15,000 from the UK Shared Prosperity Fund. That's the UKSPF. Members of South Staffordshire Council's Cabinet approved three funding requests for projects supporting district residents at its meeting on Tuesday. The authority has been allocated a £1.25 million share of the UKSPF and £146,792 from the Rural England Prosperity Fund, the REPF, to be distributed in the district during 2025-26. Some funds were earmarked towards a number of projects earlier this year. A report to Tuesday's Cabinet meeting said the street scene team have compiled a list of a variety of environmental green space enhancements to council-owned sites across the district in Great Whirley, Cheslin Hay, Brood, Bilbrook, Wanbourne, Purton and Kinver. The works include a fencing, bollards, resurfacing, patchworks and planting. £90,000 was indicatively set aside in this year's plan, and this amount is now requested to enable these works to be undertaken as soon as possible. As well as allocating these funds, Cabinet members approved UKSPF awards to Beacon Centre for the Blind and the Windsor Academy Trust on Tuesday. The Great Whirley Academy will use the £14,490 grant to create a community hub and fridge to help meet local need. Beacon Centre for the Blind, which has been awarded £10,127.25, has previously delivered UKSPF-funded projects in Wolverhampton, Dudley and Sandwell. Meanwhile, Wheaton Aston Sports and Social Club has been awarded £15,050 from the REPF. This is from the comments column. It sounds like a slightly dry technical subject, but to many who are lucky enough to be able to put some money by each month, it is incredibly important. The government is considering lowering the amount we are able to save in a cash version of an ISA, possibly changing it from the current £20,000 to £10,000. The reason? It wants to force us to invest our money in stocks and shares instead. Of course, there is nothing wrong in investing in the stock market. It is a perfectly valid way to save. But it also comes with a risk that the investment can go down as well as up. And with the economic record of government in recent years, it is hardly surprising that many people would rather go for a safe bet in the shape of a cash ISA, which provides a guaranteed tax-free return. Jeremy Cox of Coventry Building Society wants the cash ISA to remain as it is now, and he is backed by a powerful committee of MPs who say changes would do nothing to incentivise savers. As Mr. Cox says, people understand the cash ISAs. It is simple to understand and is risk-free. If people are forced away from ISAs, they will simply move on to other saving accounts that offer poorer returns. And as the Committee of MPs point out, a change of policy could also impact on the liquidity of funds available to building societies and banks, which could impact on the wider economy. The overarching message to ministers is not to meddle with a system that works. People should be able to decide how and where they invest their hard-earned savings and what level of risk they want to take. It may not be diagnosed as such, but loneliness is definitely a killer. Bereavement can come with it and the added torment of isolation, and even those who live within a family can feel the anxiety of not having a social group to associate with. The issue has been looked at by Newcastle University, which examined data on more than 2,000 men over the age of 65. They found those with higher social engagement at the start of the study had a 31% lower risk of frailty, while those who increased their social activity saw a 23% reduced risk. Social connections can have massive benefits on both physical and mental health. There are many organisations who can help find a social group. We should all look out for signs of loneliness among our loved ones or neighbours and be prepared to help them connect.
Hi everybody, this is Rosie and I'm doing the pub quiz this week as Sarah Ann is away. And this week we're going to do the specialist subject questions on reptiles. Here we go. Number one, what is the world's largest reptile? Number two, with a body length of 13.5 millimetres, the Brookesia nana nanocarmelian is the world's smallest reptile. On which island was this discovered? Number three, can you name either of the three species of poisonous lizards? Four, the venomous inland taipan snake is native to which country? 5. Which legless lizard is also known as a deaf adder? Number 6. Which three snake species can be found in the UK? Number 7. Which turtle species is so called because its tapered head resembles a bird's beak? Number 8. Which reptile has species called Bolson, Burmese star and Bell's hingeback? Number 9. What is the collective name for a group of cobras? And number 10, snakes lack ears and which other facial feature? All right, well, I hope you all had fun with that one. So here we are this time with the questions along with the answers. Number 1, what is the world's largest reptile? And that is a saltwater crocodile. Number 2, with a body length of 13.5 millimetres, the Brookesia nana nanochameleon is the world's smallest reptile. On which island was this discovered? And it was discovered on Madagascar. Number 3. Can you name either of the three species of poisonous lizards? And that's the Komodo dragon, the Mexican beaded lizard, and the Gila monster. Number 4. The venomous inland taipan snake is native to which country? And that is Australia. Number 5. Which legless lizard is also known as a deaf adder? It's a slow worm. Number 6. Which three snake species can be found in the UK? And that's adder, grass snake, and smooth snake. Number 7. Which turtle species is so called because its tapered head resembles a bird's beak? And that's the hawk's bill. Number 8. Which reptile has species called Bolson, Burmese star, and Bell's hingeback? And that's tortoise. Number 9. What is the collective name for a group of cobras? And that's a quiver. And number 10. Snakes lack ears and which other facial feature? And they lack eyelids.
Fireworks have a long history here in the West Midlands. In fact, some of the meetings behind the 1605 gunpowder plot were held in local spots like the Bull Inn in Coventry and the Old Lion Inn in Dunchurch. Fireworks remain a big part of our culture. They bring people together to celebrate, reminisce and mark special occasions. During Diwali, for example, fireworks light up the sky to symbolise light over darkness, good over evil, and knowledge over ignorance. But while fireworks bring joy and excitement, it is also worth considering their downsides too. Their constant use can harm the environment through pollution. They also cause distress for animals, especially guide dogs. The Guide Dogs for the Blind Association has found that more than a quarter of guide dogs suffer from firework-related anxiety. Dogs are particularly sensitive, because fireworks are loud, unpredictable, and come with bright flashes and unfamiliar smells that can trigger fear. If your dog is scared, you might notice trembling, shaking, restlessness, hiding, whining, barking, panting, or even vomiting. To help them cope, it is a good idea to keep them, as well as yourself, as calm as possible. Set up a cosy spot indoors with their favourite toys, or perhaps settle them by keeping the lights low and curtains closed. Some dogs even do well with calming aids like Adaptil, diffusers, a snug anxiety wrap, or even vet-approved medication for anxiety. There are lots of ways to support your dog. Tony Averis, a guide dog user for over 25 years, said, "Fireworks have now become a tradition, not only on the 5th of November, but throughout the latter part of October, New Year, and other times of celebration all throughout the year. Some of the fireworks are loud. They would sound similar to a motor bomb going off in our skies. A little more consideration of when to stop setting off the fireworks, say 11 p.m, would give us dog owners a chance to take them out to do any outstanding business needed by them. Everyone has the right to enjoy fireworks. They are part of our traditions, but let's try to do it responsibly and with animals in mind. One simple step is to ensure public displays are advertised in advance so pet owners, like myself, have time to prepare and keep their furry friends safe and comfortable. The use of low noise or silent fireworks would instead be ideal. We at Samwell Talking News would love to hear your views about fireworks. You can contact us by email on sanwelltn@gmail.com or leave us a phone message by calling 0121 699 6696 and following the instructions. Thank you for listening.
TNS Soundings.
Hello, this is Colin with a story written by Heather about an artwork that's on display to celebrate the achievements of David Blunkett. A bronze bust of the Right Honourable Lord David Blunkett, the Labour peer and the UK's first blind cabinet minister, has been unveiled at the House of Lords. It'll be on display in the House of Lords Royal Gallery until the 16th of December as part of an event by the national charity Fight for Sight, which celebrates the achievements of visually impaired people. The display also aims to draw attention to Disability History Month, which runs from the 14th of November until the 20th of December this year. As you would hope, the bust is fully accessible for visitors. In a first for the House of Lords, the sculpture is tactile and has an audio button, enabling people to experience the artwork through touch and audio description, as well as sight. It's even possible to visit the House of Lords to see and touch the bust and hear the audio. But this can only be done as part of a pre-booked tour or by contacting your local MP to request a free viewing. The bust was created by renowned sculptor Francis Segelman, who, alongside David Blunkett, is a vice president of the Fight for Sight charity. She believes accessibility is particularly important for this artwork, given Lord Blunkett's achievements as the UK's first blind cabinet member. As a Sheffield MP for 28 years, a cabinet minister for 8 years, and now as a member of the House of Lords, Mr. Blunkett has challenged assumptions and reshaped expectations of what visually impaired people can achieve. Francis created the bust in 2022 during a live speed sculpting event at the House of Lords to raise awareness of domestic abuse experienced by people with vision loss. With Lord Blunkett sitting as model, the clay bust was completed in just 2 hours in front of an audience, before later being cast in bronze. Lord Blunkett has expressed his delight with the outcome. Speaking at the unveiling of the sculpture at the House of Lords, he said, "It's a real honour to be represented in this way, and especially through a work of art that can be experienced by touch as well as sight. Every journey by individuals who are blind and partially sighted is unique. No two stories are the same. But what unites us is the determination to live full, independent lives and to make a contribution. I hope this sculpture helps spark conversations about what vision-impaired people can achieve and reminds us that difference should never mean limitation." Sculptor Francis added, "It was a real privilege to sculpt Lord Blunkett. Every time I sculpt someone, I try to capture their spirit as well as their likeness. And Lord Blunkett's strength and warmth came through from the very moment. To see the finished bronze sculpture displayed in the House of Lords is truly special, and I hope this sculpture allows people to feel the powerful energy and resilience that radiates from him."
TNS Soundings.
Some audio-described TV programmes for the next week, along with radio programme highlights from Talking News Federation. Search for publications TNF Soundings to hear these directly on their website.
TNF Soundings.
Now for the audio-described television programmes for the week beginning Saturday the 1st of November 2025. And this week they're written by John and they're read by me, Sarah. Starting with comedy on Saturday the 1st, Channel 4 has Everyone Loves Raymond at 8:40, followed by Fraser at 10 past 10, and then The Simpsons at 11:35. That's assuming you like quite an early start. Rick Stein is in Cornwall with best-selling author Patrick Gale at 12:30 on BBC Two. When a friend is injured by an evil drugs baron, James Bond sets out for revenge. License to Kill, starring Timothy Dalton, is on ITV at 5 to 1 in the afternoon. 20 years after the disaster, a new attraction is opened on the same site, but the owners are soon back in the lab. Genetic engineering and dinosaurs, what could possibly go wrong? Jurassic World is on ITV at 3:35 in the afternoon on Saturday. Horse of the Year show is on Channel 4 at 25 past 5, featuring behind-the-scenes stories from the equine world. It's Halloween for the dancers on Strictly Come Dancing at 6:35 on BBC One. Hugh Bonneville narrates the story of Isambard Kingdom, Brunel's development of the West Somerset Railway, in Great British Railway Journeys from Above on Channel 4 at 8:20. In the explosive finale, The secrets of flight CBZ51 and the killer is revealed. Nine bodies in a Mexican morgue is on BBC One at 9:20. And although not audio described, Match of the Day is on BBC One at 10:30. On to Sunday the 2nd. More politicians are put under the spotlight on BBC One at 9 in Sunday with Laura Koonsberg. Nadia takes a trip across Yorkshire in Nadia's British Food Adventure on BBC One at 11:30 a.m. Fern meets 12-year-old cat with diabetes in Fern Britain, Inside the Vets, on ITV One at 2:10. The afternoon film on BBC One is an animated story of a young boy who wants to become a musician, but his family forbid him. When he plays a guitar hanging in the crypt of a famous singer, the boy is transported into a magical world of the dead. Coco is the 5-star film on BBC One at 3:15. Hidden gems are revealed during winter in the final part of Hamza's Hidden Wild Isles on BBC One at 6:15. There's a new series tonight on knitting. Tom Daly presents the knitting competition where 10 amateur contestants attempt to impress the judges. Game of Wool, Britain's best knitter, is on Channel 4 at 8 p.m. Riot Women continues on BBC One at 9, as does Trigger Point on ITV, also at 9. Or would you rather spend a relaxing hour fishing with Bob Mortimer and Paul Whitehouse as they fish for sea trout in Carmarthenshire? Find out what they catch, if anything, in Mortimer and Whitehouse Gone Fishing on BBC Two at 9. Now a look at programmes that are on at the same time each weekday. The following are on BBC One. There's Homes Under the Hammer at 11:15 and Bargain Hunt at 12:15. Scam Interceptors is on at 2 p.m. but not on Friday. Lost and Found in the Lakes is at 2:30 but also not on Friday. And Escape to the Country is at 3 p.m. And now for the other channels. Dickinson's Real Deal is on each day on ITV One at 2. Downton Abbey Series 4 is on ITV 3 at 3:30 p.m. each afternoon. Come Dine With Me, The Professionals at 12:10 on Channel 4. And there are two episodes at Heartbeat on ITV 3 starting at 5:50 p.m. each day. And the soaps are on at their usual channels at their usual times this week. Back to the weekdays, starting with Monday the 3rd. It's brain-teasing time of the week with Mastermind and University Challenge on BBC Two at 7:30 and 8:30 respectively. Greengrocer Simon shows how he tempts his shoppers into his fruit and veg shop, while Chris reveals how his volume pricing and his one-size-fits-all approach allows him to keep prices low. Secrets of Super Cheap Shopping is on Channel 4 at 8. There's lots of choice at 9, starting with the final episode of Blue Lights, in which Lindsay's testimony exposes the Ginleys, and this is on BBC One at 9. Also at 9, the second part of the story of space exploration, with a look at the collaboration between the USA and Russia in the 1990s. Once Upon a Time in Space is on BBC Two at 9. Lana pushes herself to breaking point, now she is known to the bomber, in Trigger Point, and that's on ITV One at 9. And James's scheme to oust Jocelyn from Forsyth and Co's backfires in the Forsyths on Channel 5 at 9. On to Tuesday the 4th. Mary is joined by Gabby Logan to reflect on how her work-life balance has changed over the last 6 decades. Mary at 90, A Lifetime of Cooking, and that's on BBC Two at 7:30. The 3 finalists bake a classic British ice bun, and the showstopper is to make the largest cake ever in Bake Off history. And this is the final of the Great British Bake Off, and it's on Channel 4 at 8. The treasure hunt across Japan reaches its last stop with just 3 pairs still in the game. Will they risk their chances of winning the £50,000 prize? Worlds Apart is on Channel 4 at 9:15. Audrey delivers some home truths before Daniel is summoned to defend himself to the bishop. Murder Before Evensong is on Channel 5 at 9. As tomorrow is bonfire night, BBC 4 investigates the gunpowder plot of 1605. How did a group of Catholic Englishmen become so radicalised that they tried to destroy the Houses of Parliament? The gunpowder plot, Time Watch, is on BBC 4 at 10. And now for Wednesday the 5th. A badly bent and buckled portrait of a seafarer who led a rescue mission to save Irish emigrants stranded on an iceberg, a precious boxing trophy, a well-travelled Jamaican trunk, and a plaster bust shattered into pieces in an accident. They are all in need of help from the repair shop on BBC One at 8. Simon travels down the Padma River in Bangladesh and sees how fishermen use trained otters to help them catch fish. Tropic of Cancer with Simon Reeve is on BBC Two at 8. Rupert Murdoch comes under scrutiny as the hacking scandal explodes. The final episode of The Hack is on ITV at 9. There's a new series of Shetland starting on BBC One at 9. Calder and Tosh investigate the murder of a woman whose body has been exposed to the elements for several days. As today is bonfire night, Lucy Worsley puts her spin on the gunpowder plot and why Guy Fawkes and his co-conspirators came within hours of destroying the Houses of Parliament. The gunpowder plot, Lucy Worsley investigates, is at 9 on BBC Two. Now for Thursday the 6th. There's a new race starting tonight. Four celebrities team up with a loved one to embark on a 5,900-kilometre adventure across Central America. Celebrity Race Across the World starts at 8 on BBC One. George Clark is in Australia on the windswept Bruny Island off Tasmania's coast, where he visits a sheep farm and the home whose design is deeply influenced by the very wool it produces. George Clark's Homes in the Wild is on Channel 4 at 8. Also at 8, police are alerted to the discovery of human remains near Aviemore. Highland Cops is on BBC Two at 8. Nikki and Davina meet two siblings who only found each other as adults in long-lost family, and that's at 9 o'clock on ITV One. It's also the final of Celebrity Traitors. With the prize fund complete, will the pressure of winning impair anyone's vision? The Celebrity Traitors finale is on BBC One at 9, and this is followed by the Celebrity Traitors Uncloaked finale on BBC Two at 10 past 10, where Claudia Winkleman reflects on the series. And finally, for Friday the 7th, Joe Brand and Tom Allen are joined by Prue Leith as they welcome the finalists and the winner of the 2025 competition. The Great British Bake Off Extra Slice is on Channel 4 at 8. A rock star is murdered, forcing Mackenzie to uncover the hidden truth in the band's history. Return to Paradise is on BBC One at 8. Boyd and Regan investigate the links between gambling ring and the murder of a hurling star in Borderline, and that's on ITV at 9. A former colleague of Sister Reg is found dead, and can the sister help? Sister Boniface Mysteries is on You and Drama at 9 p.m. There's a new series looking at the British Empire from its start under Elizabeth I in the 16th century. Empire with David Olusoga is on BBC Two at 9. Finding himself back where he began, Alan wonders if he's come full circle or gone nowhere. How Are You? It's Alan Partridge is on BBC One at 9:30. And we hope that you find something of interest in this week's suggestions.
Now for a look at some of this coming week's radio highlights, starting with Saturday, November 1st. And legend, the Bruce Springsteen story continues. This week, Springsteen is in Hollywood without his E Street bandmates. 10:30 on Radio 4 on Saturday morning. Radio 4's Drama is Coming Home, the final chapter in the D for Dexter story for a young woman caring for a younger brother amid parental neglect. Sky has just turned 18 and is busy working 12-hour shifts as a carer, saving up to give she and Dex the best Christmas ever. Radio 4 Drama, 3 o'clock. Saturday afternoon. Opera on Three features Verdi's The Sicilian Vespers, a recent Royal Opera House performance. Sicily in 1282 is under French occupation, and noblewoman Helene seeks revenge for her brother's execution. Radio 3, Opera on Three, 6 p.m. on Saturday. Archive on Four this week explores the history of the International Space Station, features mission audio, news archive, and personal stories of those involved in the station's creation. Archive on Four, Out of This World, 25 Years of the ISS, Radio 4, Saturday night at 8. And lastly, for Saturday, November 1st, there's a two-part omnibus edition of The House at Number 48, the story of Anthony Easton's quest to reclaim assets stolen under the Nazis. 9 p.m, Radio 4, Saturday. Sunday, November 2nd, Lauren Laverne's guest on Desert Island Discs is broadcaster Lorraine Kelly. 10 a.m, Radio 4. The celebrations to mark 250 years since Jane Austen's birth continue with a dramatisation in two parts of Northanger Abbey. Opening lines at 2:45 on Radio 4 explores the book's dual nature, part satire, part celebration, followed at 3 by this dramatisation. Catherine Morland is invited to Bath by a rich neighbour and finds high drama and peril in each encounter with the city's fashionable society. Northanger Abbey in two parts by Jane Austen, Radio 4 at 3 p.m. Finally for Sunday, Will Greenwood visits a boat with an unusual purpose as a floating concert venue. The vision of pianist Masayuki Toyama and his wife Rihanna. Sadly, he died of pancreatic cancer in 2023, and this is a diary of Rihanna's grief and how she found a way to reconnect to a life. She starts to fill the boat with music once more that no longer has Masa in it. The piano boat, 7:15, Radio 4, Sunday night. On to those programmes then that are broadcast each weekday at the same time. So same time, same radio station, each day of the week, Monday to Friday. In Intimate Histories, historian and author Hayley Rubenhold reads 5 essays, one each day, challenging the traditional ideas as to what history is and the stories it can reveal. Intimate Histories, 11:45, each weekday, on Radio 4. Forgiveness, Stories from the Front Line, looks at how we move forward from traumatic events, beginning with an Israeli man whose parents were killed in their home in October 2023. 1:45 for this, every day this week, Radio 4. Composer of the week is the other Haydn, Michael Haydn, 1737 to 1806, the often overlooked younger brother of Joseph. 4 o'clock, every day, Radio 3, Monday to Friday. In this week's The Essay, poets explore the beauty and melancholy of abandoned spaces which have deep personal significance. In Monday's episode, Liz Berry returns to Selly Oak Library in Birmingham, which closed in 2017. 9:45 for The Essay, every night this week, on Radio 3. And two elderly men who meet 4 nights every week make a pact in the hope of one day being able to tell the other the mind of God. That's the theme of Oh Now, the novel by Niall Williams, read each night by Dermot Crowley, 10:45 p.m. on Radio 4, Monday to Friday. On to those individual programmes then to listen to through the week, starting with Monday, November 3rd. Disordered, the comedy drama by Magnus McIntosh, continues. In Light, Dark, Light, Hector is frustrated in his attempts to restore his benefits and ends up dealing with loan sharks. 2:15 p.m, Disordered, Monday, Radio 4. More short stories from John Fosk in Scenes from a Childhood. A childhood accident lives on vividly in the imagination, and a teenage boy asks a girl to dance at the community centre. 2:45 for this on Monday afternoon, Radio 4. Tuesday, November 4th, an ageing wrestler whose glory days are behind him, Ronnie Moffat, once known as the Dagenham Pork Chop, is now reduced to working in holiday camps. Then his painful past resurfaces. With Robert Glenister as the Dagenham Pork Chop, 2:15, the drama, on Radio 4 on Tuesday. In Painting with Scissors, Ruth Millington explores the history of collage, which has appeared everywhere from artworks by Picasso and Braque to LP covers by the Beatles and Rolling Stones. Painting with Scissors, Radio 4, 4 p.m, Tuesday. From 5:30 on Radio 5 Live, you can keep up to date with the action on a night of Champions League football featuring Arsenal, Slavia Prague at 5:45 p.m, Liverpool, Real Madrid at 8 p.m, plus updates from Spurs v Copenhagen. Radio 5 Live, Champions League football from 5:30. Radio 3 in Concert marks the 50th anniversary in August of the death of Dmitri Shostakovich, with the BBC National Orchestra of Wales in two works from the 1940s, Violin Concerto No. 1, Op. 77, and Symphony No. 7, Leningrad. The concert starts, Radio 3 in Concert, 7:30 p.m, Radio 3, Tuesday. And as it is a Tuesday, in touch with Peter White, the latest, for the blind and partially sighted on Radio 4 at 8:40 Tuesday night. Remember, remember, Wednesday, November 5th. In 2014, four men barged into Paul Kohler's home in the mistaken belief a large sum of money was hidden there. They were later charged and imprisoned. Although he felt vindicated, Paul's worldview changed when he and his family were invited to visit one of the attackers in prison. Life Changing is on Radio 4 at 9 a.m. on Wednesday. Drama on Radio 4 is Undercover by Rebecca Harrison. Following an arson attack on a mosque in a town in northern England, an undercover operative infiltrates a local boxing gym. In three weekly parts, the first is at 2:15 on Radio 4. And more Champions League football tonight, with Chelsea and Manchester City both in action. Radio 5 Live from 5:30 p.m. on Wednesday, November 5th. Thursday, November 6th, in moderation, is the Radio 4 drama. Esther's sister has taken her own life after watching self-harm videos online. And soon Esther herself finds herself struggling to cope in a world far darker and more complex than she could have imagined. Radio 4's drama, In Moderation, 2:15 on Thursday afternoon. And in this week's Ramblings, Claire Balding joins earth scientist and author Anyana Kwatwa in a coastal walk in Dorset. Their route takes in clifftops, caves and fossil-rich coastline as the pair discuss subjects from geology through to belonging. Radio 4 for Ramblings at 3 o'clock. Finally, Friday, November 7th, and the final part of Limelight, The Betrayed, is Radio 4's drama. Now suspended from her job, Louise realises that her brother Frank is in touch with organised extremists throughout Europe, which could bring Ireland and other countries to the brink of chaos. Limelight, The Betrayed, 2:15, Radio 4. And we end this week's recommendations with Friday Night is Music Night. Anna Maria Helsing conducts the BBC Concert Orchestra in a concert showcasing music used in TV programmes. There's Rossini's The Lone Ranger, Sousa's Monty Python's Flying Circus, Sibelius's The Sky at Night, Cacciatrean's The Aeneiden Line, plus many, many more. Enjoy a night recalling some of your old and not so old TV favourites. Friday Night is Music Night. Radio 3, Friday night, 7:30. That's it. Thank you to Angela for the highlights this week. May I wish you a peaceful, safe and enjoyable one of radio listening.
TNS Soundings.
Hello, this is Trevor reading articles from the Express and Star from Tuesday, the 28th of October. The Albion debrief. Away day worries return once again. This article is by Lewis Cox. Albion slumped to a late defeat at Ipswich to make it a miserable week on their travels. Here we look at some of the Baggies' latest talking points from a reverse at Portman Road. Away concerns. The last three performances away from the Hawthorns and four of the last five have brought very little cheer for the travelling faithful. Indeed, even the successful outlier in that sequence, the 1-0 win at Norwich, required a lot of fortune, a goalkeeping masterclass from Josh Griffiths, who was at fault late on down the road at Portman Road. It is the opposite start to the Championship season, where Ryan Mason's side won at Wrexham and Stoke to banish last season's away blues. The defeat at Middlesbrough in mid-September was poor, but the house were flying at that point. The no-show at Millwall was a cause for concern, and the second half of Watford and Suffolk showing has exacerbated it. Home form is and always will be a priority, but a section of the travelling support aired their ire towards Mason at full-time at Ipswich, and Albion will know when they go next away to Charlton on Tuesday week, they must do much better. No effort on target until late into stoppage time is unacceptable for Albion in the Championship against whichever side and whichever context. There was no attempt from Mason to say otherwise, and he was clear to say the final third was lacking. But he did try to explain the setup primarily to defend and be compact, was born out of a demanding period of the scheduling of a kick-off 60 hours after Watford, something Mason has been angry at, and the lack of bodies with injuries biting at a small squad. The head coach has also stated that some players, Josh Madger, Colin Grant and Daryl DK among them, cannot play regularly yet due to returning from injuries. Ultimately, it was the head coach's call and Albion was 7 minutes or so from a decent draw. The problem with playing in that manner is it will only be accepted if it yields the point. Incomers struggling. There are individuals in Mason's side that really struggle to move their side forward into Ipswich's half. Usama Diakite is a fourth choice central midfielder being selected due to injury, with Mason's hand forced in that regard. Diakite is a physical unit and excels in certain scenarios. Late on to protect results, to clear lines aerially and to break up play with challenges. He does not excel with the ball at his feet and it makes things a struggle in that department. He's not alone. George Campbell, still playing out of position at right back, defended well, was another side's better players, but is another who struggles in possession from an attacking perspective. Lonely Charlie Taylor was selected over Callum Stiles, who is more forward-thinking with the ball. Taylor is more physical and was selected with defending in mind. Hope for home comfort. After some away misery, four of the next six games are at the Hawthorns, either side of the international break. An important win against Preston last time out eased some home nerves, but Crisis Club Sheffield Wednesday and Lowly Oxford are the next two visitors. Albion must make home advantage count there. It leads into a midweek clash under the lights against Birmingham. There will be no shortage of feeling in that one. Bid for more houses on landslide estate rejected. This article is by Christian Barnett. An attempt to build more homes on a new build estate cut off after a landslide has been blocked by a council. Dunedin Homes, the developer behind the 53-home estate off Halesowen Road in Cradleyheath, wanted to add six more homes to the development on a patch of land previously used as a storage yard and haul road during the construction of the wider estate. A total of 30 objections were lodged against the plans before Sandwell Council made a decision. Rejecting the proposal, the council's planner said, the development would have a significant impact on privacy and overlooking of existing residential properties at lower land levels and would appear overly dominant and overbearing from the habitat rooms and gardens of these properties. The site layout would be cramped with poorly designed run of parking to frontages and areas of communal bin stores. The local authority added, the application did not adequately reorganise the nearby nature reserves, wildlife corridor or conservation sites. The estate, which was completed in 2020, has been plagued by issues, including several landslides that left a huge mound of earth blocking the road and cutting off a dozen homes. The six new 3- and 4-bedroom houses would have been built on a new cul-de-sac around 150 metres away from Hayden Cross Drive, where landslides spilled over retaining wall and blocked the road and would have been accessed via farmhouse close on the edge of the estate. A number of trees would have been chopped down to make way. The subsidence in nearby Hayden Cross Drive was first seen nearly 2 years ago when a tree fell into the nearby woods and it was aggravated by subsequent bad weather. An undercrypt concrete retaining wall was built at the bottom of the slope by PHI Group. The contractor's website says the wall is made of a durable solution that provides maintenance-free 120 years, but cracks began to show just 18 months later. Heavy rain and bad weather throughout the year came to a head in the run-up to Christmas, with land breaking through and a huge mound of earth leaving the road completely blocked. The tons of soil left the cul-de-sac area cut off and homeowners without access to their driveways. A statement included with the application said, the site is in a sustainable location, relates well to the wider context to the site and has been designed with the aim of creating a vibrant and inclusive community. The proposal creates high quality residential development set within an attractive open space setting that will deliver high quality placemaking while providing much needed new homes. Residents are celebrating their post office reopening. This article is by Paul Jenkins. Residents in an area of Wednesbury have had their post office services restored and in a newly refurbished building. Crankle Lane Post Office has reopened under new management after a major refurbishment at the same location. The branch has been temporarily closed since June due to the resignation of the postmaster. The new owners have completely refitted the whole premises and a new fascia is in process of being installed. It will be open Monday to Sunday, 7 a.m. to 10 p.m. with a wide range of services available, including everyday personal and business banking, mail services, bill payments, vehicle tax, foreign currency and Western Union money transfers. Shrinkflation piling pressure onto our household budgets. Not only are some products getting smaller, but others are being downgraded. This article is by Josie Clark. So-called shrinkflation is piling pressure on household grocery budgets, with coffee, toothpaste and even Gaviscon dwindling in product size, which has found. The consumer group asked shoppers to share some of the worst examples of shrinkflation they'd seen at the supermarket in recent months, finding that not only are products getting smaller, but others are being downgraded with cheaper substitute ingredients. Among the examples are Aquafresh Complete Care Original Toothpaste, which was increased in price from £1.30 for 100 millilitres to £2 for 75 millilitres at Tesco, Sainsbury's and Ocado, 105% rise per 100 millilitres. Bottles of Gaviscon Heartburn and Indigestion Liquid shrank from 600 millilitres to 500 millilitres, while at Sainsbury's the price has stayed at £14, a 20% rise per 100 millilitres, which also found that Sainsbury's Scottish Oats had shrunk from 1 kilo to 500 gram, while the price increased from £1.25 to £2.10, a 236% rise per 100 kilos. Nescafe Original Instant Coffee shrunk from 200 grams to 190 grams at Tesco, Morrison's and Asda, a rise of 5% per 100 grams. Shoppers reported many examples of whole chocolate bars missing from multipacks as the cost of confectionery's raw ingredients soar. In one example, which found Kit Kat Two Finger Milk Chocolate Bar multipacks dropped from 21 bars to 18. While at Ocado, the price also rose from £3.60 to £5.50, a jump of 53%. Shoppers planning to buy chocolate tubs for the festive season may notice lighter boxes this year, the watchdog warned. Quality Street chocolates have been reduced from 600 grams to 550 grams. While the price for the smaller tub at Morrison's increased from £6 to £7 this year. Meanwhile, Cadbury multi-packs of Fred Out and Fudge bars both dropped from 5 bars to 4 at Morrison's, Ocado and Tesco, even though the price of £1.40 did not change. Tributes to a brilliant actor of the old school. Co-star says Crossroads Cad was a lovely man in real life. This article is by Mark Andrews. One day, while crossing a bridge at the former Central Television Studios in Birmingham, an intruder charged at actor Tony Adams with a knife. The man, who was quickly apprehended by security staff, took exception to the way Crossroads scoundrel Adam Chance had been mistreating little rich girl Miranda Pollard and decided to avenge her honour. The Midlands Motel melodrama was routinely panned by critics for its unbelievable storylines, but this man certainly believed what he saw on screen. Actor Tony Adams, who played raffish bounder Adam for 10 years in the original run and then revised the character in the 2001 to 2003 revival, has died peacefully at the age of 84. Former co-star Paul Henry, who lives in Whitchurch, told the Star that he spoke to his old friend only last week. He said Adams, who shot to fame as the debonair Dr. Neville Bywaters in the 1970s soap General Hospital, had died on Saturday with a smile on his face after enjoying a meal with his wife Christine. He was a lovely man, says Henry, who spent 13 years at the motel's slow-witted handyman Benny Hawkins. We finished Crossroads in 1988, but we always kept in touch. How many people are you still in touch with from 1988? He was multi-talented, a really good singer, a brilliant actor of the old school, like a lot of us. He learnt his trade in theatre, later moving into television. Anthony Sawley Adams was born in Anglesey, Wales in 1940, and later trained as an actor at the Italia Conti Theatre School. As a child, he appeared on the London stage, notably alongside the young Kenneth Williams, in a production of Peter Pan at the Scala Theatre. He first appeared in Crossroads in 1966 as a minor character, Mr. Perkins. But his big break came in 1972 when he landed the role of consultant paediatrician Dr. Bywaters in General Hospital, another soap opera set in the Midlands, which he remained with for its entire seven-year run. He recalled how viewers, unhappy with their own doctors, would write to him seeking a second opinion. In 1973, he played evil chemical firm boss Elgin in the six-episode Doctor Who storyline, The Green Death. Although he was taken ill part of the way through the series, and Ray Skelton was drafted in as a new character, Mr. James, to finish his lines. However, it was a smooth-talking cad, Adam Chance, that Adams is best remembered, making his first appearance as the smooth-talking accountant in 1978, and quickly establishing himself as one of the series' main characters, as Adam convinced motel matriarch Meg Mortimer, played by Noel Gordon, that he was indispensable. Major storylines watched by more than 15 million people saw Adam steal and then break the heart of Meg's troubled daughter, Jill Harvey, and he also played a central role in the controversial Bonfire Night episode in 1981, where Meg was apparently burnt alive in an armchair during an arson attack in which Adam became prime suspect. The episode led to the switchboards of West Midland hospitals being jammed by viewers concerned for Meg's welfare. But their fears were eased a few days later when Meg sensationally reappeared on board the QE2. Adams told producers he wanted to leave the show in 1987, but changed his mind on hearing it was being scrapped the following year, and remained in the series until the final episode in April 1988. Adams vehemently defended the oft-derided soap, although he initially turned down the part of Adam, fearing that filming five episodes a week would be too heavy a workload. Producer Jack Barton reportedly replied, "Well, Tony, you got it wrong, because in actual fact, we'd do six, and Adams took the part anyway." He died at Sussex County Hospital in Brighton on Saturday with his wife Christine by his side.
Albion Match Report. Kieran McKenna's substitution paid off as Jack Clark bagged a late winner against West Bromwich Albion at Portman Road with his fifth goal of the season. McKenna threw on Clark, Ivan Azon and Jens Kajuste, and all three combined to score within 7 minutes. Kajuste won the ball on the edge of the West Brom box to feed Azon, and when his shot was parried by Baggies goalkeeper Josh Griffiths, Clark fired home into the roof of the net in the 83rd minute. Ipswich fully deserved to end their two-match losing run, and West Brom created very little. They remain in 11th place, 2 points off the playoff places, ahead of Saturday's later games, while Ipswich are now just a point behind the Baggies. McKenna will be delighted to get their promotion campaign back on track after Wednesday's horror show when they lost 3-0 at home to Charlton. West Brom only mustered one effort on target in the dying minutes as they tried in vain to salvage a point, having gifted Ipswich such a soft goal after defending so well for so long. It was all Ipswich as West Brom sat back and attempted to soak up the host's pressure, and Jaden Philogene a bright spark for the home side. He had a fine right foot shot brilliantly saved by Griffiths before visiting goalkeeper held another effort from the winger. Jack Taylor's direct run ended with him dragging a shot wide before Norway midfielder Sindre Edley saw a drive blocked. Ipswich maintained the pressure and Taylor found Marcelino Nunes in the box only for the town striker to shoot wide. But the home side were getting closer and Egli scuffed a left foot effort past the near post when he should have hit the target. The pressure finally paid off, 7 minutes from time, after some great initial pressing, and the Tractor boys are motoring again. Ryan Mason said. Josh Griffiths needs to learn from his mistake in gifting Ipswich their goal from a poor pass out. It's something he needs to learn from. We all need to learn quickly. It's disappointing to concede in the nature we did. At the end of the day, we've given them a goal and we need to improve. It's disappointing and we all need to take responsibility and all of us have to learn from it. We lacked a bit of creativity in the final third. In the second half, we had a 10-minute spell where it was our moment to attack them and try and cause them some problems. But that didn't materialise, and that's disappointing. News and information from Sandwell Council. New monument honours the Black Country's Second World War reserved occupation workers. A stunning new sculpture honouring Black Country workers who carried out reserved occupations during the Second World War is to be unveiled in Sandwell. And people are now invited to put forward names of family members who held reserved occupations to be added to the monument in time for its unveiling at St Luke's Churchyard, Crayley Heath, this November. Black Country sculptor Luke Perry was inspired by his grandfather, Eric Atwood's story, to create the 12-foot-tall steel sculpture of a worker accompanied by a real anchor where names can be engraved. A chainmaker, Eric Atwood was one of around 5 million men covered by the UK's Schedule of Reserved Occupations during the Second World War, which covered jobs essential to the war effort and daily life, working alongside women on the home front. The monument, called Fighting from Home, has been part-funded by the Arts Council, together with Luke and his family's factory, Solid Swivel, in Cradley Heath, who have donated time and materials. Sandwell Council has provided advice and support throughout the project, including carrying out a clean-up of the churchyard ahead of the monument's unveiling ceremony at 2 p.m. on Remembrance Sunday, the 9th of November. The monument's unveiling this year coincides with the Remembrance Sunday closest to the 80th anniversary of the end of the Second World War. Luke said, "This is something I have wanted to build for 10 years, as my granddad and many of his friends had been in reserved occupation during the Second World War. These men who couldn't sign up for military service as their trade was so important to the war effort. Like many men and women around here, he was a chainmaker and made Navy chain during the war. This monument is in memory of these uncelebrated men, many of whom suffered immensely from survivor's guilt and a real fear that they didn't play their part despite the importance of their work. As a monument exclusively to reserved occupationists, I think it is unique in the UK and certainly unique in the Black Country and Industrial Midlands, where there has never been a memorial in recognition of these vital workers from that period. The monument will stand on the site of St Luke's Church, now demolished, which was the historic home of many chain and anchor-making families, it being further along the same road as Hingley and Sung's, where the Titanic anchor and chain were made in 1910. Luke added, "The sculpture's features are based on my granddad, as he was quite a striking man, and I hope that this is a fitting tribute to him and the many men of his generation who served the cause to fight fascism in their own way. I am very proud to have been able to make something that feels so solid and befitting to these men who sadly did not see any recognition in their own lifetimes. I hope this will be a symbol of strength and comfort to the families of those who worked and continue to work in important roles without which we could not be free." Councillor Kerry Carmichael, Sandwell Council leader, said, we will join together at our annual Remembrance Sunday services and parades in November to commemorate the service and sacrifice of everyone who has defended our freedoms and protect our way of life. These services will have added poignancy this year, with it being 80 years since the end of the Second World War. And we will proudly honour all those who served in our armed forces and their families from Britain and around the Commonwealth. We will remember those who sadly never returned home. We are also rightly proud of our industrial heritage, the role our industries and everyone on the home front played in the war, and of industries that continue to thrive in Sandwell today. This humbling new sculpture, Fighting from Home, will pay tribute to all those Black Country workers who played their part in reserved occupations. This will ensure their stories and contributions to the war effort are remembered for generations to come. It is very fitting that the sculpture and anchor will be installed in Cradley Heath. It's close to where many men will have worked in reserved occupations alongside women during the war, and just up the road from Luke's Women Chainsmakers Monument at Mary MacArthur Gardens. I hope Fighting from Home becomes a monument shared by people across Sandwell and the wider Black Country. To put forward names of family members who carried out reserved occupations in the Black Country during the Second World War, please contact Luke Perry by emailing mr.l.perry@googlemail.com, or you can call him on 07710379000. People are welcome to attend the unveiling ceremony for the Fighting from Home Monument, which will run from 2 p.m. till 3 p.m. on Sunday the 9th of November at St Luke's Churchyard, Upper High Street, Cradley Heath, B64 5HY. Find out about remembrance services and parades across Sandwell's six towns on the Council's website at sandwell.gov.uk/remembrance. Read how Sandwell is marking 80 years since the end of the Second World War by planting 80 native trees across six local parks. Sandwell Council wins Gold Award for Animal Welfare. Housing team recognised for outstanding commitment to animal welfare in Sandwell. Sandwell Council is proud to announce it has been awarded gold for housing in the RSPCA Paw Prints Award 2025, the only scheme of its kind in England and Wales. This prestigious honour recognises our commitment to developing pet-friendly housing policies and proactive support for pet owners in housing. The Paw Prints Awards celebrate local authorities, public bodies and partners that go the extra mile to protect and promote animal welfare. Over the past year, Sandwell Council has strengthened its commitment to promoting responsible pet ownership amongst tenants. This includes ensuring that permission is sought before a pet is kept in a property, that animals are housed in safe and suitable conditions, and that their welfare remains a priority throughout tenancy management. The council also collects important information such as pet descriptions, microchipping details where required, confirmation that pets are legal, and alternative contacts in case of emergencies or the need for rehoming. Having previously held the Silver Award, this more proactive approach was a key factor in securing the Gold Award. Also recognised by the RSPCA was Councillor Jeffcoat and Independent Councillor for Tipton Green, who was awarded the Massingham Advocacy Award for his commitment to improving animal welfare in Sandwell. As a member of Sandwell Council's Animal Welfare Task Force, his efforts have helped raise awareness, build partnerships, and place animal welfare firmly on the local agenda. Councillor Kerry Carmichael was one of the first recipients of the Massingham Advocacy Award when it was introduced in 2024. So, with Councillor Richard Jeffcoat receiving it in 2025, two of the first six recipients are councillors in Sandwell. Lee Gingle, Public Affairs Manager at the RSPCA, said, We're delighted to recognise Sandwell Council with the gold category in housing in this year's RSPCA Paw Prints Awards. Their commitment to animal welfare is truly commendable, and we hope their example inspires others to strive for excellence.
In September, SVI organised an evening walk in Blackheath, led by Nigel Self. The walk set out to reveal some of Blackheath's lesser-known landmarks. One of the most surprising stops was the church in the garden. This tiny church was actually built in the garden of a private house. SVI enablement worker Kelly described the garden around the church as beautiful and full of blooms, with the soothing sound of running water and koi carp swimming in the pond. Nigel had invited Martin Pearson, grandson of the church's founder, to talk about its history. Sandra said, "The church was amazing. I had no idea it existed." Sonia added, "The church visit was fascinating and something new for me." SVI and Sandwell Talking News thought that you, our listeners, would love to know more about this secret church. So we asked our roving reporter, Prince, to go with Nigel to interview Martin and find out more. SVI would like to thank the Sandwell Active Travel Community Grant Scheme for the funding which made this walk possible. Now listen on for the interview.
Hello, so I'm reporting at the Church of the Garden in Blackheath, Sandwell. I'm here with Martin Pearson, who's going to explain a brief history about the church and its impact on the community. Martin, how did the idea of building a church in this backyard come about? Why did your grandfather do it? What was his motivations?
Mainly because he had some difficulty with the church that he was going to.
Mm-hmm.
And the group of people that used to come to help him distribute tracts started coming and having services at what was a shed in the garden.
Oh, yeah.
And it was from that, and he decided from that just to do his own thing.
Really. Yeah.
He was quite a shy man. It suited him. And so that's how it really started. Obviously, this was long before I was born. So
yeah.
I don't know too much of the detail, but essentially that's what he did.
So the second thing I want to ask is, I know that he said he converted to Christianity from a non-Christian family. But when he started this church, was it like as a personal thing for him, or did he want it to be known to the community of Blackheath?
I think he wanted it to be known. It wasn't just a private chapel in his garden, as it could be. But he did want it to be known because of the work that he'd already done with tracts and leaflets in the area. And also he had been involved. A group of him and some friends used to go around with a big tent onto what were known as the fairgrounds around the Black Country.
Yeah.
Okay. And they used to have evangelistic meetings, you know, preaching. And one of his friends was a good singer, and they used to sing. And my granddad used to lead those services. So he was very much involved, as was proved in his later life, in reaching people with the message of the Christian gospel.
Yeah.
So it wasn't a personal, selfish idea for him. He really wanted others to know the good news of the Lord Jesus Christ.
How many people would you say attended it when it first started getting known versus how many attend it now, really?
It only had 30 seats. The old building had these 30 seats that you see here.
Mm-hmm.
And there would have been times where there was only a handful of people. There would have been other times where there was maybe 20, 25. In the early days, probably up until the end of the 50s, there was a Sunday school. So there used to be 20, 30 children used to come on a Sunday. We've had then here up until we ceased operating, really, a congregation between 15 and 20. One Saturday night meeting, we had about 55 people in this room.
Oh, was that recently?
No, it was a few years ago. It was for a lecture on John Bunyan.
Okay.
If you know Pilgrim's Progress and the writer John, one of the Puritans, and it was a lecture a friend of mine came and gave on there. We had 55 people. I used to play the piano for the services, yeah. And so I couldn't get off the piano. So there was nowhere to go. So it's one good thing playing the piano, you're guaranteed a seat. So it varied, but at times there were only a handful of people.
Yeah.
And then but other times there was a more regular conversation.
And do you still hold light services?
No, we don't at the moment. It was a long story that I've told Nigel already, but basically there were just a few of us meeting here. But because of some work that I was involved with Christian Mission to Eastern Europe, I was unable to do the two things.
Oh, okay.
I couldn't be in two places at once.
Yeah.
And so reluctantly, because at the time I'd got a lot of choice, we decided to wind up the meetings here.
Mm.
We still use the building occasionally for prayer meetings for the mission that I am still connected with, although I'm retired now. We still use it occasionally for that. So we don't use it at the moment.
Mm.
It's not to say that we won't start again.
Yeah.
But I'm involved in ministry in other local churches, helping them at the moment. So again, it's not possible for me to be to do all the things. And quite a few churches are struggling these days. There's not many people. Some churches are big. Mm-hmm. Lots of people, and other churches are very small. So I'm trying to help through either speaking, preaching, or in a lot of cases playing the piano, because not many churches have got pianists. So
yeah.
So I'm able to multitask and help in that. And I feel that's more what I should be doing at the moment than just doing the church in the garden, you know.
Mm.
So, but it's not to say we won't.
Nice.
Start.
Maybe for you, what do you think were some of the most memorable moments for this church as it grew? Like, you've seen this church grow, this church in the garden, you've seen people come. So what were some of the most memorable moments seeing it grow from what it started as?
I think people who, again, like my grandfather, who'd not grown up in a Christian background, come along out of curiosity and then be converted to become believers. That above all is the most important thing.
Yeah,
and the most remarkable thing, miraculous thing, really.
Yeah,
that somebody does that, and that happened a lot in the church here. There have been specific moments I mentioned where we've had church full. I suppose some of the other big events have been we've had funeral. We've never had a wedding here.
Oh, okay.
Because we're not well. You couldn't at one time, and we hadn't got a license. We maybe could now if people wanted to do it. But funerals of dear friends and people associated with the church, they've been memorable occasions. I remember in the old church one night we had a male voice choir.
Okay.
And a male voice choir of about 20 men, 25 men stood at one end of the long shed. It wasn't this wide. It was only half this. The old church was only half as wide as this room you see now.
Right.
So, but they came in and sang, I remember, and some special times. With people, we always had visiting. My granddad didn't do all the preaching. He wasn't like a vicar as such,
Yeah.
And so we always, for many, many years, had visiting speakers from other churches and locality.
Mm.
And so we had preachers from as far as Bedford or somewhere like that, And then there were some guys in Coventry who for a long time used to come over on a Sunday. And in the early days as well, when some of the people first came to Wolverhampton from the West Indies, from Jamaica and what was the name of the boat? What's the boat?
The Windrush.
I think they were, I don't know, but they were people who came there. My granddad somehow got in touch, came in contact with them. And although I don't remember it, my mum used to talk about the fact that they used to travel on the bus on a Sunday from Wolverhampton.
Yeah.
Which in those days, the bus service wouldn't have been. I'm talking about the 1950s.
The bus service, even today, is not great.
Yeah, yeah. the X8, you know. They used to come on a Sunday, and they used to come for the service, and then they used to stay here. My nan and granddad used to feed them. Mm. And because my mom always used to say, she says, oh, they were amazing. She says, they would have everything on the same plate. Mm. It was a different cultural thing, you know. They would have meat and veg and fruit and that, yeah, all together. I know my mom talk about it a lot because she remembered it because she was always here, you know. And they used to come and then go back after, yeah, on a Sunday night, which must have been an horrendous sort of thing to do in those days, you know. And they did that for quite some time, apparently. Mm. And I believe that then eventually those people formed their own church. I think it would be classed today as like the New Testament Church of God in Wolverhampton, you know, because there were some really deep, good friendships and fellowship that people had. My granddad was this sort of gentle figure, and people really warmed to him. And if I was to introduce you to somebody who knew my granddad, they would talk very fondly of him. They loved him, you know. He was that sort of guy. So yeah. He wasn't aggressive. He wasn't arrogant. He was very, very humble, very pious, really. And he was a character.
And thanks to Prince and Martin for bringing us that interview, and we'll be continuing with it next week. So thanks this week go to all the readers who were Mia, Linda, Gavin, Linda, Janet and Trevor. And of course, thanks to everyone else, Pam, Sue and the team for coordinating the readings and the readers, and to Tony and Gavin for doing the distribution at the Town Hall. And do get the pen drives back to us quickly, please. That's it for this week. In touch coming up soon, all about Braille music and the future of Braille music transcription. For now, I have to sign off for this week, but we'll be back with you next week. Bye-bye for now.
To use our talk phone service to listen to Sandwell Talking News or leave us a message, phone 0121 699 6696. If you are using a landline in the 0121 area, then just dial 699 6696.